Welcome back to the Kevin Roberts Show. As you've probably noticed, if you have tuned in the last couple of weeks, we have changed the format of the show because of feedback from you. You were saying, listen, Roberts, just talk to some interesting people. We're interested in them. We don't want to hear you go on. And so we are really excited, all of us at Heritage and a handful of you who know we have this guest, to have Dr. Marty McCary here with us. He's a professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. You may know, as we will talk about momentarily, that Dr. McCary, with a wonderful smile on his face, kept giving us the truth about COVID vaccine mandates, as we will discuss as well, thinking about the long term, also how we need to redesign the American healthcare system. So that's a long-winded way of saying thanks for your feedback. And of course, if you're still tuning in, it means you must like the show. And if you've not yet given us a 5-star rating, we'd be very grateful. And if you're still a little pensive about doing so, I guarantee you, by the end of this conversation, with all of the credit due Dr. McCary, you will want to do that. So, Dr. Marty McCary, I feel like we've been friends for a while. We've been poking around on Twitter for the last few years, which is sort of like the devil's playground.
Right.
But you do a really good job of that. All of that to say, thanks for being with me.
Great to be with you, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
So, being a Southern guy, as you can tell from the set, I'm a little interested in people's backgrounds and what gets them motivated to do what we do. So you and I are going to talk about COVID vaccines. We're going to talk about big government and how it intrudes in your relationship with your patients. But before we do that, tell us why you do what you do.
Well, my dad was a doc in rural Pennsylvania, a small town. And when I would see people in the grocery store come up to him and thank him, and sometimes thank him in tears, you realize there's something magical about the medical profession where you can enter this incredible trust relationship quickly. They'll let you put a knife to their skin within seconds of meeting you simply because you're the doctor. So I was always interested in science, and I thought it was a really great thing to be a part of.
Man, that's a very humble, succinct way, as almost every doctor I've met has said, to indicate the help that you and the men and women in your profession offer us. And so I'll just say, I wasn't planning to say this, but it's really heartfelt that for all of you in the medical profession, thank you.
Thank you.
And not just the last few years, but for what you do. And you know, we're going to get into some policy here where I think both you and I, with as much cheerfulness as we can muster, we'll probably do a little bit of punching, as I like to say, mostly at policymakers, certainly not at medical professionals, or at least most of them. There's one in particular we might. But the point is that that often can obscure that Americans ought to be proud of the medical system that we have, right?
I think that's right. Look, there's no benefit in playing a blame game, but we've got to evaluate the largest public health intervention in human history. We can't just leave it up to opinions and then repeat it, arguing that, you know, this was one narrative of whether or not it worked.
Yeah, that's right. So let's jump right in. Your politeness, you keep wanting to bring this horse back to the water, which is, let's talk about COVID mandates, Kevin. So that's what we're going to do, Dr. McCary. So here it is, 2022. I'm a historian. I always tell people you should not rely on historians to predict the future. And so I think about 2.5 years ago when COVID started, and my then colleagues were telling me, Kevin, this is a really big deal. And I was thinking, no, this is not a big deal. It's America. But obviously, it was a huge deal. And while we might get into some civil society lessons that actually might have been silver linings to this, obviously, from your position, not just as a surgeon, but also as someone who spends a lot of time analyzing public policy, there are just a number of lessons that we've learned. What are the top two or three before we get into some pretty significant detail?
Number one, I would say, is humility. We saw almost none of that.
Yeah.
When people were asking us questions, the right answer many times was, we don't know.
Right.
Right. Instead of do this, do that, don't ask questions. And then I think structurally, in terms of what we can actually fix on a public policy level, is that if you look back, when COVID hit this country, all of us in medicine were getting peppered with the same reasonable questions. Mm-hmm. How does it spread? When are you most contagious? How long do I have to quarantine for? Do masks work? Are young, healthy people at risk? What's the risk in people who are older with comorbidity? All of those questions were logical. We did not do the research to answer them. The NIH failed to pivot their $45 billion budget to answer the most basic COVID questions. And what that meant is that doctors and nurses in America were left with no evidence, no studies to answer those popular questions out there. So what happened was, as those studies were deferred, mostly because of the bureaucracy, we allowed opinions to fill that void for months and even years. We didn't get the studies on masks until 2 years into the pandemic. We didn't know about surface transmission versus airborne transmission 3 months into the pandemic. That study could have been done in 24 hours.
Yeah.
That is your job. When you're at the NIH, when you're a public official, and you're this is your role. You're at NIAID, you're at CDC. Your job is to do that study in 24 hours with all of the might of government and our thousands of laboratories with hoods and test tubes. You do that study to answer the public question, is it airborne or is it surface transmission? Because we had Americans throwing 50 gallons of alcohol-based solutions on their mail and groceries, and then they were spreading the infection unknowingly through a mechanism that they were misguided on through bad information. So that was the original sin of COVID, not doing the research to answer the big questions. And we still are arguing about some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We still argue about cloth masks and covering the faces of children, and do the studies and they will tell us the answers. They did not do those studies. There have been schools that have been open free and clear, and there have been open schools that have been closed and covering the faces of children. Where is that data on transmission rates? Where's the data on hospitalizations? That elegant study could be done. It's not being done. This is the first time we're seeing science used as political propaganda in the United States.
So does that make it difficult, therefore, given the lessons that you've just mentioned, for Americans who want to be objective to quote unquote trust the science?
Yeah, it does, sure. Look, you look at the public respect right now for CDC recommendations. I mean, it's at an all-time low. I worry we may get hit with another big pandemic. Mm-hmm. We may need people to do something. We may need everyone to wear an N95 mask. Who knows? Depends on the virus. Depends on what nature hands us. But right now, the credibility is in the toilet. We've had, if you think about the last 100 years, pandemics are frequent. Mm-hmm. In the last 110 years or so, we've had Spanish flu of 1918, polio, Zika, Ebola, H1N3. We've had SARS, MERS. I mean, that's just in the last 100 years or so. We're definitely going to have more. And so right now we are down. We are, most of our learning scientifically came from other countries, Israel. We did not have a medical establishment that embraced different opinions. There was a groupthink from on high. And it was, rather than do the research to answer whether or not it's surface or airborne, or whatever the question was, just listen to us and we're going to have, you know, hail an edict from on high and everybody fall in line. If you don't, we're going to marginalize you, cancel you, remove you from the public debate. That is never good for science. And so I think that's one of the lessons now people have come around to realize is that cancel culture is not good for science.
Especially in the middle of a pandemic, right?
Yeah. And people are see through now the lies. I mean, people feel like they've been lied to for 2 years, and in many cases, they're right. Mm-hmm. They were lied to about surface transmission, natural immunity, vaccine mandates in young, healthy children. I mean, so many different things now people are realizing, hey, has any young, healthy child ever died of COVID in the United States? CDC won't tell us. We don't know. Germany, they looked at it in kids 5 through 17. It was zero kids in that country died who were healthy. All the deaths were clustered in kids with a comorbid condition. Now, look, there may have been some in the United States. I think there have been a couple. But we instituted martial law on the weakest, most defenseless population in the United States. For what? To prevent transmission of a common cold-like virus that has an infection fatality rate no different from influenza in that healthy population. And we ignited a mental health crisis. And so I hope people recognize that the kids that couldn't just go virtual and log on because in inner city Baltimore, it's different from the Hamptons in Santa Barbara County. And that when school went back in person, they never showed up. Those were kids lost to the system. We have a duty to rescue them.
Well, we do. And you know better than most that the nature of mental health illness is that that will take years to address, right? Yeah. And so we probably could spend an entire episode talking about that. But I want to home in on maybe a silver lining to all of this. Yeah. I do think there are a few. One of them is, at least from this layman's point of view, a handful of governors, maybe local officials, and I don't mean this in a partisan way. I mean, it doesn't matter to me what political party those you respond with belong to. But from your vantage point, given your expertise as a surgeon, health public policy professional, are there some governors, local government officials who really acquitted themselves well and through trusting whatever science they could, using some common sense, not being worried about public opinion polls, actually did well in terms of the lack of information they had, trying to balance all of the competing goods during the pandemic? Sure. Anyone you give an award to?
Well, look, I think any governor that kept schools open throughout mm-hmm. did probably avoided one of the greatest public health catastrophes that was ignited by the COVID response. Mm-hmm. When COVID hit this country, the blame game was going around hard. People were telling me it was this political official or that politician. And I would respond and say, are they also responsible for the epidemic in France? Yeah. And, you know, unless you were an island country guarding your borders with intense airport checks, every country got burned badly. Now, mm-hmm. there were some goofball policies that were basically in total denial that you needed to do anything. You can't go totally, you can't have no response. You've got to protect the nursing homes, right. Targeted protection. But, you know, full disclosure, I advise Governor Glenn Youngkin in Virginia, mm-hmm. and I think he's been spot on in what he's put out there. But yeah, we need to. My concern is that every state is writing their own narrative, and their own populace is believing that narrative.
Yeah.
In Palo Alto, where I just was, there's this essentially a COVID zero strategy that mm-hmm. still is seen in the policy. My favorite, there were two milestone moments in the pandemic for me. One is when they canceled the Masters golf tournament, I knew we had lost our mind.
Yep.
Outdoors, young, healthy athletes, right? There are ways to have that tournament, and people they need their livelihoods. You can't shut down society. And the second was a study, maybe the most significant study of the whole pandemic, done by a Stanford student. I've talked to him. He's an amazing guy. He noticed that there was a bicycler from Stanford biking through an intersection in a busy construction zone against traffic with flip-flops on and AirPods in his ear, no helmet, but he had a mask on.
And it's sort of in microcosm what we're fighting, right?
It is. It's this distorted perception of risk. And so he did a study and found that 47% of bicyclers in Palo Alto were wearing a mask, but only 17% were wearing a helmet.
That says it all.
Yeah.
I don't mean this in this gratuitous way to pick on somebody just for the sake of it, but I just have to say, and I'm going to cut to the chase. Let's say a different alternate reality. Dr. Marty McCary was president of the United States. How long would Anthony Fauci have remained on the job?
Look, I don't believe we should have people in charge of healthcare policy for terms that equate that of African presidents. They should at some point move into an advisory role.
Right.
And look, I respect Dr. Fauci, and I told him that. I said, look, you've done an amazing job serving this country through some different stressors. But at this point, that his role, in my opinion, should be advisory. Mm-hmm. What we have instead is that if Dr. Fauci does not recognize natural immunity, no one in the country does. He has way too much clout. So ironically, nurses have circulating antibodies to COVID, but they are antibodies the government does not recognize. Dr. Fauci does not. And so they get fired from their jobs for not being vaccinated. Mm-hmm. I think he's a dinosaur. I just have a different opinion. I don't think he's bad. I don't think he's malintended. I actually mm-hmm. think he's well-intended. He's living in a bit of a bubble, mm-hmm. and I just have a different opinion. The problem is that he and Dr. Collins crowded out the other mm-hmm. opinions, right? That famous email that talked about the fringe epidemiologists, mm-hmm. like basically—
They weren't so fringe.
They were correct. Yeah. And so, you know, Jay Bhattacharya and a lot of these guys talked about focus protection. They called for a devastating takedown. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even though he's one of the kindest gentlemen you will ever meet, mm-hmm. and that's true. That is true of Dr. Fauci. The behind-the-scenes bureaucratic jousting of shutting down any other opinions for the sake of having a common message. You know, the idea of telling the country every single human being has to be vaccinated and boosted is good for the marketing department. It's simple and it's streamlined. Mm-hmm. It's just not scientifically accurate. There's never been evidence to support boosting young, healthy people. And when we push them on that, you know, it's as if it's time for dogma to rule the day. So he's a complicated man, Dr. Mm-hmm. Fauci. I think he's done some good in the past, but I think at this point we needed so I believe in diversity mm-hmm. of ideas, backgrounds, perspectives, and that includes age diversity.
Right.
And when everybody calling the shots are, you know, in their 80s or 70s, you're missing out on a perspective that's based on my generation and younger, which has more of a bent towards social justice,
right.
Equality, fairness, and pragmatism.
Mm-hmm.
So when I think about a mandate, I think about what's it going to do in rural Washington State, where the 55 nurses are going to get fired at MultiCare, which is exactly what happened. They had natural immunity. And then when they get hit with the Omicron wave, which they did, they told their COVID positive nurses that were calling in sick, come in anyway, even though you have COVID, we don't have enough staff. They had fired those with natural immunity. That's what I think of when I think of mandates. And I think when you live in a bubble, there's this sense of demonization of people you don't really mm-hmm. understand. I grew up in rural Pennsylvania. And so, look, I understand why people have distrust of the healthcare system. I want to try to convince them to get vaccinated if they haven't had COVID already, especially mm-hmm. if they have risk factors. But when the mandates hit, it created never vaxxers.
Yeah.
They saw the long arm of government. They repelled against that. And my job as a doctor was significantly impaired in convincing people to get vaccinated because of the mandates.
So how do we fix that as a society? I mean, I know from conversations with other doctor friends, it's difficult just on the doctor to individual patient relationship, right? I was joking about that with a good doctor friend of mine last week. But so we take, I guess the point, Dr. McCary, is we take what we know to be reality, which is that we're Americans. And so the more we distrust government and the more these people, and not to pick on him, but I'm just going to speak on behalf of tens of millions of Americans. You're being a gentleman about it. Anthony Fauci personifies the problem, which is that NIH is a bureaucratic mess. We're spending way too much money, respectfully, because hopefully we all get the opportunity to age gracefully and work long. He's a dinosaur, to use your words. I mean this to be as polite as I can, but the point is he personifies the problem. Americans say, to heck with it. I'm not getting the vaccine, even if I trust my doctor who's saying I should go do it. So the point is, writ large, across this immense country with 330 million people, how in the world do we ever restore that trust, given the experiences we've had?
I think an apology would go a long way in rebuilding that trust. I can tell you, taking care of patients, that if something goes wrong and somebody is frustrated at me, they may assign the blame to me fairly or unfairly. If I immediately own it, there's an incredible forgiveness that people have in the general public. I think of a patient once where I ordered the wrong CAT scan. I ordered a CAT scan that got done on the wrong patient. Now, I don't know if it was a clerical mistake or I gave the wrong name. It was, you know, in my haste,
This is like
busy.
A nightmare, Doc.
Yeah, well, at least it was only a CAT scan.
Yeah, well, this is true.
Unnecessary image of their abdomen. But this guy was already frustrated at me, this one patient. And I thought, gosh, great, he's going to sue me now. He's already frustrated with his care. And I went up to him and I said, look, I know you've been frustrated with your care. I want to tell you about something that's unfortunate. You had a CAT scan you didn't need. It was my fault. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to get the results for you right now. I haven't seen it, but I just heard about it. I want to come to and tell you right away. That guy looked at me and smiled and said, Doc, thank you for being honest with me. Mm-hmm. And that man never sued me. We are Facebook friends today.
It says a lot.
It says a lot. Yeah. So, I mean, people are very forgiving. I think if public health officials said, look, when we said wash your hands like crazy, mm-hmm. we were wrong and we should have had the humility to do that research quickly and tell you what the right answer was. We were wrong about natural immunity. We were wrong about all sorts of stuff. That would go a long way, gain of function research.
Yeah.
So Dr. Fauci and Dr. Collins famously wrote articles and gave lectures at universities talking about the importance of doing gain of function research. If ever there were gain of function research advocates, you know, like in your world of politics, you have Republicans and Democrats. We have pro and anti gain of function people, mm-hmm. right? Those are kind of our boundaries. And the pro gain of function party has been led by these two people. They wrote a famous op-ed in the Washington Post, why we need to be doing gain of function research. Now, I don't think they want to ruin the world. Right. These are good people. I mean, mm-hmm. both of them are good people. But they're dinosaurs because in the old days when it took a long time to sequence the genome, you would want to Frankenstein the virus and create it in the lab ahead of its natural development in the real mm-hmm. world to try to develop therapeutics. You wanted to get a head start. Right. But now you can sequence a virus in 20 minutes with modern PCR technology. And so we're like, why so are these necessary. Guys? You don't need to do yeah. it.
Okay.
So that's the – so look, they should just say we got gain of function wrong. Mm-hmm. We're sorry. I don't think the money that the U.S. government gave – the Wuhan lab directly resulted in this mm-hmm. virus, but it looks bad.
It does.
And they shouldn't have done it. And by the way, we can't even fund prenatal vitamins in the United States for women in some states, and we can give a Chinese lab money to Frankenstein a novel coronavirus. Doesn't China have enough money themselves to do this if they want? I mean, what are we doing, right? Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes in those bureaucracies, you lose the forest from the trees.
Yeah. Yeah, we see that, unfortunately, throughout history, not just in the United States, but across the world. And yet, I think one of the things that distinguishes us as Americans is even though we go through these very challenging periods socially and politically, and we go through these periods like we just have with a pandemic that the government made worse with its overwrought responses, we still look forward to the next time around being a heck of a lot better. And it really speaks to our expectation that the decision makers be humble, but also just a tremendous level of forgiveness, which is natural to humans. It's profound in the history of Americans politically that if someone, whether it be the president or Dr. Fauci or someone say, look, we're really sorry, this is what we're going to do better, I think you almost have Americans in the cup of their hands. But the point is, how do we fix these problems? And I mean by that to cue you to discuss how we fix the healthcare system writ large, how we need to think more effectively regarding healthcare policy, because as someone who has led a couple of policy organizations, each of whom has spent a lot of time and money trying to improve the healthcare system, we remain very frustrated. But perhaps to get to the end of my question here, Doc, we can have a silver lining coming out of COVID that motivates us as a people to say, we're going to fix all of this once and for all.
I think first of all, to answer your question directly, I think we need new people mm-hmm. and I think we need young people. Mm-hmm. I think there's a generation of doctors, residents, nurses, researchers who think differently. They don't want to be on the hamster wheel that they're watching the senior doctors and scientists run on. They don't want to be forever chasing NIH grants to do small incremental advances in science. They've got big ideas.
Yeah.
They want to study different topics. They look at an NIH where it's siloed. They look at doctors practicing who are frustrated with the system, but they just pick up their check every 2 weeks. There's too many people in healthcare just picking up their check every 2 weeks. We need to disrupt this system and redesign it altogether. And when you look at the silos at the NIH, they're based on organs, right? We got a center for kidney. We got a center for, you know, allergy. How about food as medicine? Hmm. How about studying environmental exposures that cause cancer, not just the chemotherapy to treat it?
Right.
How about treating high blood pressure with sleep medicine and stress management, not just antihypertensives?
Yep.
How about talking about school lunch programs, not just bariatric surgery funding in Medicare? People are seeing through this sort of these artificial lines that we've created in medicine, and they want to start over. And right. that's the exciting revolution that we call the redesign of healthcare.
So let's engage what I call magic wand thinking. This is a lot of what we do at Heritage. All my colleagues know it's not our job to be bashful. Let's dream big. Let's go make this country even better. We're giving you the magic wand to redesign the healthcare system. What does it look like?
We got to change the payment model.
Okay.
So right now we're just paying for every time you use the whack-a-mole hammer.
Yeah.
And so we're treating people with such late stages, and we have no economic incentives to go upstream.
Right.
I would say in terms of the pandemic, we need to have a rapid response research funding mechanism, because the NIH took on average, and this is a study we just put out in BMJ, took 5 months to issue their funding from their announcement. So they said, we're going to announce a study of masks with COVID. After the announcement, 5 months until the researchers were handed the money. By the way, there were only two studies on masks out of $45 billion at the NIH in 2020.
Part of the problem.
That is the core original sin. So we need to be able to respond quickly in the future. And it's not just viral pandemics. Mm-hmm. What about all the other forms of health emergencies that we see? So all of those need a vehicle for rapid funding instead of scrambling for ventilators in China. I hope to God we never again go shopping for ventilators and PPE in China. We should have learned that lesson.
Let's hope. I mean, I'm laughing, but I probably should cry. So let's sort of try to tie with a bow if we can, although we're apparently not officially at the end of the COVID pandemic. A couple of aspects of that. You mentioned something almost in passing that I wanted to home in on, and that is that you're a medical advisor, policy advisor, Governor Youngkin in Virginia. What are, to the extent you can comment on this, what's the governor seeing? What are you and your colleagues who are advising him seeing in terms of the tail end of the pandemic? And also, of course, what lessons you might leave the governor with in case there is another similar episode?
We talk a lot about mental health. So we created a mental health crisis. A study from the CDC, of all places, showed that 44% of teens feel sad or depressed most of the time. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't have half your nation's kids in depression, clinical depression. Now, we can take the old NIH route of the medical establishment and medicate them all, or we can get at the root causes. Mm-hmm. We deprive them of their livelihoods. And so that introspection, the research and the rescue behind those kids that have been ruined by the pandemic and a lot of the stuff that we throw at them, that is the big focus right now of a lot of the work that I know the governor's interested in. I don't speak for him, but I'm a huge fan. And I'll tell you that the mental health crisis right now is not one that you fix in one day or one policy or one bill. It is a massive long-term effort. And if it's not a priority, if it's just a lip service talking point, as you see at all the big medical conferences, all the medical conferences I go to have some panel, usually the main panel, where they talk about the importance of mental health and addressing social and health disparities. Mm-hmm. Well, they all feel good about themselves because now they've talked about it at their conference, and careers have been built from talking about these issues. I think there's two types of people in the world, talkers and doers. And if you look at what we've been trying to do, we had these disparities right in our face. Twice a week testing for college students that are universally vaccinated, boosted, and already immune and ultra low risk. And then local people in the community, African Americans, minority communities, mm-hmm. and those who are poorer could not get testing. This is a socioeconomic disparity right in our face, and nobody was talking about it. So I think it's a lot of we have blind spots that mm-hmm. we need to unmask, as much as we need to talk about future theoretical ways that we can address these.
Sure. So I'll get into, thank you, I'll get into some broader questions here, including some advice you have for listeners on the medical and life front. But before that, I feel like I've got to ask a question on behalf of a lot of people, probably millions of Americans, who are not kooks, they're not conspiracy theorists, but I'm sure they've listened up to this point of the episode, very grateful for your analysis. But probably what they would say, accomplished men and women, is it seems like we've got to rebuild the CDC from the ground up. That's why I smirked when you said the CDC, as I thought of that question. And they're grateful for the men and women who are there, all of those things. But they're looking for, you know, some sense from you. Yeah, you're right. That just from a common sense point of view, over the last 2.5 years, as you've seen, speaking for them, you know, these conflicting pieces of information, both Republicans and Democrats, it's not a partisan comment, that when we think about healthcare moving forward, whether it's for a pandemic or whether it is for day-to-day healthcare, that we really do, as doctors, as patients, as policymakers, have to start from scratch. Are those people on the right track when they think that? Because we hear this all the time at Heritage, is stop putting Band-Aids on the problem. Just rebuild the system from the ground up.
That's right. And probably there's no better example of throwing good money after bad into a broken agency than the proposal to double the amount of funding to the CDC.
Yep.
They already have 21,000 employees and have been unable to tell us of all the children who have died of COVID, were any of them healthy and what percent, how many? We've imposed tremendous restrictions on 51 million American kids who are healthy based on zero data on healthy kids. The number one indicator of the entire pandemic, the one that we should have followed closely and still need to follow closely when all of these arguments recycle and reignite in the winter, when we will see a bump in cases for sure. Mm-hmm. Cases will ebb and flow for a long time. Mm-hmm. I don't like it. I'm sorry. If you don't like it, you can go blame the gain-of-function scientists that brewed this up in the lab. But when cases bump up, the key indicator is hospitalizations for COVID, not with an incidental COVID positive test when they're there for another reason. That is the key metric. That is the one metric the CDC has never provided, has no interest in providing. And without that level of precision, you inflate the perception of what's actually happening in the hospitals. That is ironic. You have 21,000 employees. So look, if the CDC really wants to regain credibility, apologize, get some fresh leadership in there, provide real-time data as it's available, fund the research they need to fund, break down the data as people need to see it, as with kids, and stop using science for political propaganda. They have never disclosed the hospitalization rates for vaccinated people who are boosted versus unboosted in people under 50. We know they have that data because they disclosed it for the group 50 to 65 and over 65. Mm-hmm. What about those under 50? Well, the reason they haven't disclosed it is it flies in the face with their dogmatic recommendation that's based on no science to boost people under 50. It's a lot of people, a lot mm-hmm. of lives there they've ruined mm-hmm. by insisting they leave their jobs and be dishonorably discharged from the military right. or fired as a teacher or a nurse because they did not get boosted or, you know, primary vaccine series in somebody with natural immunity. So I think they need real-time disclosure of data. They need to fund those key studies to answer the key questions quickly. Mm-hmm. And they need to provide the key indicator, which is hospitalizations for COVID.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that excellent summary. It makes it hard for those of us who are not scientists to trust the science when it's being politicized every day. And I know it's got to make it especially hard for those of you who are scientists and or medical professionals when you hear that. And so what I love about you, Marty, is that you don't just diagnose problems, but like a good surgeon, you want to fix them. And I wanted to mention this anyway and was able to get my hands on a couple of your books. One is Unaccountable. One is The Price We Pay. You didn't come here to sell books, although we're happy to help you do that. I would recommend to our audience that you read the doctor's books. But tell us about these two books in case someone's interested.
So Unaccountable was sort of my experience in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, it turned into the TV series The Resident, if right. you've seen that. And The Price We Pay was basically trying to explain our cost crisis in a way that everyday people can understand, like The Big Short did for the financial industry. Mm-hmm. Because if you leave it to the experts, as we did with the financial industry, they will use wonky terms and tell you, look, this is too sophisticated for you to understand. Leave it to us.
Yeah.
And so there are many ways that we can fix healthcare without the government by making smarter purchasing decisions through price transparency, which I'm proud to say, based on policymakers who read the book, The Price We Pay, it resulted in the Price Transparency Executive Order, which is mm-hmm. now the law of the land. And so good stuff is happening. The entrepreneurs, the early stage companies disrupting healthcare, going direct, direct contracting. Most businesses are getting ripped off on their healthcare benefits. They can make smarter purchasing decisions. Mm-hmm. And so the book is a bit of a storybook like The Big Short to take a complicated subject and make it understandable to everyday folks. And I think ultimately we want to see attention on the underlying causes that bring people to disease,
right?
Not just the care itself.
Right. Well, thanks for that great pitch. So a couple of final questions before we wrap up. One of them is unique to you as a doctor. So the one I always ask people is why are you optimistic that in spite of all the challenges we've had. But before we get to that one, as we were walking on the set, you said here, Kevin, love the set, but there's this unopened bottle of Texas bourbon and you know, people can keep drinking that and they'll keep me busy.
Yeah.
So the second to last question, Dr. Vaccari, is what life advice do you give to listeners, to members of the audience? It can be purely medical. It can be, you know, sort of social advice as we come out of this pandemic and try to return to normal life. You're an optimistic guy, which is why I'm interested in hearing this answer from you.
Yeah, and I am optimistic on healthcare. I think there's a lot of gloom and doom, but if you look at what the disruptors are doing, if you look at the way now, you know, for 50 years, if you asked someone in the hospital, how much is it going to cost for me to deliver my baby here? They gave you the runaround. For 50 years, we gave people the runaround. Now the market is demanding that we produce prices. And when you start seeing competition, all of a sudden, a lot of the waste gets cut. So the fundamental problem in healthcare is that we have non-competitive markets.
Right.
And when you see that as a policymaker, you want to create rules to stop the bad behavior. But what you really need to do is convert them to competitive markets.
Yeah.
And that's what we're starting to see now. We're seeing apps and patient navigation and steerage and direct primary care saying, hey, we're going to send you to, you know, your pregnancy test is positive. We're going to send you to an OB that we trust, we respect. They have a C-section rate of 19% as opposed to 61%, which we see out there in low-risk deliveries.
Yep.
And they're not going to engage in what we call predatory billing.
Yep.
Billing quality is medical quality, and financial toxicity is a medical complication, and it's measurable.
Yeah.
So when you see, when someone at Google read the book, The Price We Pay, and they said, what can we do? I said, you guys are Google. When somebody types in a hospital, don't just put their name and address, put the name, address, their average price markup, their leapfrog quality score, and their performance on the 5-star billing quality score that we pioneered at Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And then you have start to have competitive markets that reward hospitals that are doing what they were designed to do. Most hospitals in the United States were built by churches or philanthropists. And they had an amazing charter of my own hospital, Johns Hopkins, to care for the indigent of the community, regardless of one's race, creed, or ability to pay. That is our great medical heritage. When Jonas Salk invented the polio vaccine in 1954, his business friend said, you got to get a patent on this. This will be the most lucrative patent in patent history. And he said, no, this will be a gift to mankind, the property of humanity, so as many kids in the world can get it as possible. That is our great medical heritage. So many times, all we need to do is just remember that great heritage when we talk about fixing healthcare.
And so it sounds like your advice with those eloquent words to folks in the audience is aspire to that as a people. So I have a pretty good idea how you might answer this last question. And that is, in spite of all of the challenges of the last few years, why did you wake up optimistic about the American future today?
I just see so many of these disruptors that are bypassing the sort of waste-laden middleman industry in healthcare. Mm-hmm. We spend almost 50% of federal spending on healthcare if you count the hidden forms. The fact that we buy private health insurance for 9.1 million federal workers, and the VA and the Defense Department has its own healthcare system, and half of Social Security goes to healthcare. Co-pays, deductibles, non-covered services, and then Medicare and Medicaid. So right now we're spending half of federal spending roughly on healthcare. When I meet with politicians on both sides of the aisle and they want to come up with a healthcare plan, I'll say, okay, what are your goals? And they'll say, well, you know, I want to increase whatever entitlement program. Great. We're at 50% now. What do you suggest we go to? 80, 90, 100? Let me give you a suggestion. How about we cut the waste? Because there's a tremendous amount of waste when we remember our great heritage. We go direct, direct primary care, direct contracting with employers and hospitals, app-based direct purchasing, direct drug purchasing. There's so many of these disruptors that leave me optimistic. And I go through them all in the book, The Price We Pay. But there's so much exciting stuff going on right now. I'm very optimistic. And the number one thing, the number one reason I'm optimistic are those young people who want to redesign healthcare entirely.
Yeah. Thank you for that comment. Thank you, Dr. Marty McCary, for joining us, and most of all, for being a great American who really is improving the lives, not just of your own patients, I'm sure, but so many of us who benefit from your common sense.
Well, great to be here. Thanks so much, Kevin.
You bet.
Appreciate it.
Well, I hope you all enjoy that as much as I did, cutting through the nonsense of the age with a lot of common sense. Stay tuned for next episode, where we'll have another great American who will help us do the same. Take care.
The Kevin Roberts Show is brought to you by more than 500,000 members of the Heritage Foundation. The executive producer is Crystal Kate Bonham. The producer is Philip Reynolds. Sound design by Lauren Evans, Mark Guiney, and Tim Kennedy. For more information and to subscribe, please visit heritage.org.